Trouble on the Border, John Ferguson. John Purchase, of the political staff, waited on the broad platform of Lahore Railway Station for the southbound night express. He was like a keen young dog straining at the leash, for the mission on which he had been sent out was both delicate and dangerous. It was, besides, his first big job. He knew that out at the Anarkali headquarters, some thought the business far too delicate for him to handle, while saying it was far too dangerous. He did not know that the chief had insisted on sending him in spite of all protests, for Purchase considered he had earned this job, and for this reason. All through that summer, the political administration had been aware that there was bad, black trouble brewing in the Punjab. At first, it was evident only to the sensitive and experienced heads of the political staff, but after certain news filtered through from the Tigris, the symptoms could be read by the rawest subaltern out with the last draft from home. The bazaars seethed with disaffection, and the native police spies were for once at fault. They all came in with reports of a mysterious and subtle propaganda working like leaven through the native quarters, but they never got hold of anything precise and specific. The military administration, when they began to feel the pressure of the rising temperature, clamored for something to be done. Beyond insolent looks, however, there was no overt act for a long time, and from this it was inferred that a very strong hand held the hidden strings of intrigue. Then, one afternoon, in broad daylight, on the mall, a stone was flung at a deputy commissioner as he mounted the steps of the club. It laid his chin open, but for all the notice he took, it might have been no more than a fly settling on his cheek. Purchase had chanced to see the incident, and he overheard the scant sympathy afforded the sufferer by the soldiers present when the commissioner came in mopping up the blood.
"Now," an old colonel growled, "perhaps you political swells will do something."
"Do no end of good, that stone. We all need waking up at times," another agreed.
"Sorry old Jenkins got it, though. Good chap. Should someone go out and tell them that they hit the wrong bird?"
"Yes, I'd like to see some other civil blighter get it in the neck. Hard."
"What are you proposing to do, Jenkins?"
another asked the commissioner. Jenkins looked over.
"Do?" he said innocently. "Oh, I don't know. Apply some sticking plaster if the steward has any."
There was a chorus of indignant grunts over this willful misunderstanding of the question. Jenkins relented when the steward left the room.
"As a matter of fact," he said, "we are hanging on to this thing with teeth and nails. You think it's bad. I tell you it's 10 times worse than you think. The Punjab goes on fire usually like dry straw, and it's easily stamped out. This time there's something holding them back for the moment, but it will be a bonfire when it comes."
"Meanwhile," the colonel persisted, "what are you chaps doing?"
"Looking for the man with the match," said Jenkins.
"I heard it said he is a Rajah of some native state,"
Blaine interjected.
"Who told you that?"
the commissioner asked sharply.
I forget," said the other.
The colonel thumped the table.
"Then," he cried, "why not send out half a platoon to fetch him in?"
"There are 34 native states in the NW provinces alone," said Jenkins. "To which would you send?"
They waited till the steward who had come in with the plaster had withdrawn. Purchase had been amused at the blank look with which this information had been received, but he knew that to many of these native states men from his department had already gone, not in platoons, but singly and unobtrusively. First one, then another, went east, west, south, and, yes, even north, though he did not go by rail or travel as a sahib.
"I heard," said Blaine again, "it's some Rajah with a diamond who's piling up the trouble."
Jenkins laughed as he drained off his peg and got on his feet.
"Now we're getting warm," he said. "We've only to find out which of the 34 Rajahs owns a diamond."
They all laughed at Blaine then, and in the midst of the merriment, Jenkins left. Young Blaine got very red, and turning aside to Purchase, began to explain.
"But this was a very special diamond, something supernatural, a gift from some old god or other."
"Who told you about it?"
Purchase asked, affecting interest.
"Oh, I don't mind telling you that," said Blaine. "It came from one of my men. There was a native woman got soft on him. This jewel, it appears, is a sort of Aladdin's lamp affair. Lord, isn't it all here rather like the Arabian Nights? The holder of the gem, it seems, can get anything he wishes. It's a regular rag with my men against Saunders. He's the man the woman warned, you know. The other fellows pretend he's got it in his pocket and go up to him asking for the most impossible things. When they get nothing from him, they say it's because he's a Scotchman and keeps it all to himself.
Purchase did not need to affect interest in the anecdote now. Knowing his India, he recognized the possible value of the clue chance had put into his hand. It was just in this way a hint might percolate through, a hint utterly beyond the reach of their native police spies.
"I've a great wish to see this, Saunders," he said at length.
"Easily gratified," said the youthful Blaine. "He's my batman, but don't mention the diamond. It's like a red rag to a bull. He's been chafed no end. They call him Bumali Bill now."
"Bumali," said Purchase.
"That's where the girl came from.
I say,"
he added in a changed tone,
"you don't think there's anything in it?"
"Do you think we could get hold of the woman on the quiet?"
"I'll find out tactfully,"
said Blaine, sober enough now.
"Come to tiffin tomorrow."
"No," said Purchase. "I'll come now."
They went straight out to the cantonments, and after a little judicious handling, Saunders first told his story, and then, when it was dark, took them round to the ladies' quarters. They had some difficulty in getting in. When they did succeed, they found her in bed, with her throat cut. Her tongue, looking like a little red snail, lay in a brass plate standing on her breast. Blaine held the lamp high, looking down with fascinated horror.
"Seems we are too late," he said stupidly.
But nevertheless, if that gaping and tongueless mouth did not tell John Purchase all he had hoped to learn, it yet spoke eloquently enough, for it was a witness to the seriousness of what she had said. This was no idle babble of the bazaars. Inside 20 minutes he had laid the facts before his chief.
"How many people know this?" the old man asked.
"About half a battalion, perhaps."
"That's bad. Still, they don't know the story of the Bumali stone."
"I'm afraid they do, sir," said Purchase. "You see, they are a mixed lot, drawn, Blaine says, from all sorts of occupations, and one of them, who was an assistant librarian in some municipal library, has hunted up the story of the diamond in order to rag this man Saunders."
"Do they know the stone was lost centuries ago?"
"Yes, and they pretend Saunders has got it."
The chief took a pace or two away, hands behind his back.
"This is a queer thing, Mr. Purchase. The tradition is that the Bumali jewel was given to the Sundra dynasty in the 9th century by the serpent god Nag, and that it brought with it the supernatural power which enabled the Sundras to drive the Mohammedan invaders out of Upper India. When it was lost, the House of Sundra was said to have lost its power, and the British Raj became paramount. Now, Mr. Purchase, take this tradition in conjunction with the present unrest in the Punjab, and let me hear your explanation."
The old man stopped before Purchase and eyed him under his grizzled brows.
"I should think, sir, they are about to find that stone."
The chief extended a hand and patted his shoulder.
"You'll do," he nodded approvingly. "That is what is going to happen. That old fox, Duleep Sundra, will find it or another, and when he does, there will be another mutiny."
He sat down at his desk and gave himself up to thought.
"Somebody's got to go to Bumali," he said at length, half to himself.
"I'd like nothing better,"
Purchase promptly affirmed. The chief turned to look at him consideringly.
"You? Do you know the sort of place it is? There's Duleep Sundra, the Rajah who can contrive accidents for unwelcome white men that look more natural than nature can make them. And they'd know you were coming. You'd be expected, you see. No, that won't do."
Again he fell into profound meditation while Purchase waited, watching his face. Occasionally a half-whisper fell from his lips, but beyond a disconnected word here and there, the young man overheard little. Bitterly disappointed at not getting the mission after his hopes had risen so high, Purchase had ceased to look at his chief and, disheartened, let himself sink back in his chair to regard the toes of his boots. How long he sat so, with only the solemn tickling of the clock audible, he did not know. But anyhow, he was suddenly startled when he did look up to find the chief staring at his face, a new light in his eyes.
"I am going to send you to Bumali," he said quietly.
Purchase was thunderstruck, and jumped impulsively up to thank him. But the other put up a hand as if to ward off the gratitude.
You can thank me when you come back, he said so brusquely, uncomfortably, that Purchase somehow felt he himself was but a pawn in some game about to open between players of ruthlessness and skill. Out there in Bhumale sat the subtle Raja, Duleep Sundra. Here in Lahore, the wise old chief. And Purchase knew that if the first had all the wisdom of the serpent from which his dynasty was said to descend, the chief had on his side a good deal more than the harmlessness of the dove. Within 24 hours he seemed to have decided his game, and John Purchase was moved up to the big platform of Lahore Station. His instructions were to go to Bhumale, stay there with Sam Burgoyne, the resident, and nose around. Purchase, being young, would have much preferred to go in disguise, but this the chief absolutely prohibited. He was to be quite open in all his movements, as if on a friendly visit to the resident. As he walked up and down the platform waiting for his train, Purchase wondered much as to what all this portended. That it was a move in the game he did not doubt. Then his eye lighted on 2 soldiers coming along the platform through the motley throng of natives, and he thought that they, at least, were in disguise, since anything less martial would have been hard to find. Both were undersized, but one had very bandy legs. He wondered what their occupations in civil life had been. But when they squatted on their kits and began to exchange hilarious repartee with each other, one soon gathered a variety of information about both. They were, it seemed, on leave, going down to Amritsar to visit friends in another regiment quartered there, and their names were Alf and Fred. They had no reticence whatever. Even their past love affairs and present financial position they discussed aloud with complete frankness. Purchase was vastly amused by their boyish high spirits and by a contrast to the pair which presented itself when a couple of majestic Sikhs came down the platform, silent men with dark, inscrutable faces, their heads, as it were, towering among the stars. As they passed the jabbering pair who had come out to assist in holding the Punjab, Purchase was struck by the immense cheek of the thing. It was as if the gutter snipes of Bermondsey had taken over control of the London police. Even to allow men away on leave at such a critical moment, that also was pure cheek. It was an affectation of strength on the part of the military who, as Purchase knew, were all the time most seriously alarmed. Then the express came thundering in, and the noisy pair passed out of the young man's mind. He had 2 changes to make before he reached his destination. At Karapur he had to take the branch line which runs on to Ataka Finagar. Some 30 miles short of that terminus, at a little place called Bagya, he had to change into the Rajah's private narrow-gauge railway, which ran up for some 50 miles to the capital. It was at Karapur that Purchase again, much to his surprise, fell in with Alf and Fred. He saw, or rather heard, them at 3 o'clock in the morning tumbling out of the express after their heavy kit. Soon a mighty noisy altercation arose between the 2 soldiers and the railway officials. The station master, a Babu who spoke English, was summoned. But as the Babu, who had probably been educated at Bombay University and whom Alf addressed as Sambo, spoke a very bookish English, not in the least like the kind affected by Alf and Fred, his intervention only increased the dispute. In the end, Purchase offered his help. "You passed Amritsar 2 hours ago," he said. Fred eyed him doubtfully, as if uncertain which side Purchase was taking.
"That's right, old sport, we saw it."
"Oh, I thought you were going there," said Purchase. Overhearing this, Alf turned from the gesticulating station master.
"We only said that at Lahore to the kid in the red cap. We're out to see a bit of the real India before we go back home."
The bandy-legged Fred slapped his friend on the back.
"That's right, old 1134," he cried approvingly.
Then Purchase, observing that the station master seemed to be entering the figures in his notebook, drew the 2 companions away toward the Ataka Finagar train. He spoke to them like a father of the many dangers into which they might easily run their simple, careless heads. The view that they were simple-minded seemed new to them, but as an example of their simplicity, Purchase instanced the mention of Alf's regimental number before a native official who, merely out of self-importance, might report all sorts of crime against them. Hearing this, a fit of merriment so overcame both that they gripped each other for support.
"Lord bless you, that wasn't his regimental number,"
Fred cried, wiping his eyes.
That's only the name he goes by, 1134. Him having been a draper before he joined up.
A draper? Cried Purchase.
Yes, Alf agreed. Served me time at it in Acne.
And your friend? Purchase asked.
Me? Said Fred. Oh, I was what you might call a furniture remover, though I was bred as a house decorator, really.
And where exactly are you going?
To see a bit of India. Native state for choice. Jungle, elephants, but no snakes by request.
Alf and me was always fond of the zoo ever since we was little nippers, wasn't we, Alf?
Fred took his friend's arm affectionately, shaking him so that he rocked on his bandy legs. Now, it might have been very awkward had the pair by some chance blundered into Bomali. Purchase saw he must head them off.
What about Attica Finnegar? He suggested,
well knowing that once the train reached that terminus they would be taken care of by the military police. Fred wiped his mouth.
Don't mind, he said, if the refreshment room is open.
Lime juice for me,
Alf put in.
Them foreign drinks upset me stomach.
Purchase explained the situation to them very seriously, warning them above all to keep clear of native states. At first they seemed very much impressed, and had quite a number of questions to ask, but in the end they turned his warning, as they turned most things, into a jest, as is the way with soldiers out on a spree.
Supposing we got into trouble and they caught us, what'd happen?
Fill you with red pepper, perhaps.
Anything else?
I've known them to tie a man up, pull his head back, fix his jaws open, and let water dribble into him for days. Do you think they'd make it beer for a London boy?
Fred asked with affected eagerness. Purchase then lost patience with them and spoke sharply. Still, the warning did not seem to have been in vain, for when Purchase left the Attica Finnegar train in Bagya and transferred himself to the Rajah's little train, he saw nothing of the two wanderers, and he thought of them as peacefully sleeping, their heads on their kit, till the train ran into the terminus, where they would be roused up by the hated Red Cap on duty there. At Bomali, Purchase was met by Burgoyne.
Bit run down, I hear, said the resident, gripping Purchase's hand very hard.
So-so,
he returned, taking the cue as they passed through the line of Punjabi officials.
Well, Burgoyne nodded, Bomali will set you up all right. Pretty hot in Lahore, I'm told.
That's it, Purchase assented, and as there's nothing doing, the chief gave me a holiday.
Burgoyne laughed heartily.
Oh, Lahore is a dull place. There never is anything doing there.
Well, as a matter of fact, most of the staff are always on leave,
Purchase rejoined lightly. But once they were alone and closeted in the study, the careless gaiety dropped out of Burgoyne's manner.
There's something afoot, he said. The place is just too damn quiet. It frightens me.
Purchase related the recent developments in Lahore, and Burgoyne questioned him about his interview with the chief, more particularly in regard to the instructions he had received.
I have got to smell around, that's all, said Purchase.
Well, said Burgoyne, you won't light on much. The Rajah is away too, although that in itself is not a disadvantage.
For the first few days, Purchase loafed about the house, playing the part of the semi-invalid, seeming to take an interest in nothing, but wondering all the while what eyes were upon him. Then he began to stroll about the place in a languid fashion, but with much alertness behind his apparently lackluster eyes. He never lighted on a single hint of anything in the wind. Not a ripple showed on the surface. Bomali was as placid as a sleeping duck pond. Purchase feared he would have to return with no more than that to report, while aware that there was ever so much more if only he could put his hand on it. That would mark him out in the chief's mind as a man who had failed. It gave him a sort of sensation as of nightmare, and he felt like a man who had only to crack an eggshell to save his life, but whose hands were bound with cobwebs which he could not break. Then one evening, when he was returning in something like despair, Burgoyne met him at the door and drew him into his study. His sais, Abdullah, had brought in the rumor of a great tamasha about to be held in the old temple out in the woods. Abdullah had been concealed in the stables to surprise some corn thieves when three stable boys entered, and he had overheard their talk.
A gathering, Purchase cried, but there's no room in a temple for many people.
This old temple belongs to the primitive worship. It's not a mere shrine like a Hindu temple,
Burgoyne explained. What do you make of it, then?
What I think, said the other, is that the secret underground work has now been done, and this meeting is being held to stir up fanaticism in the mob.
Purchase nodded agreement. You mean the fanaticism that sets a crowd on fire when it is moved by a common purpose?
Exactly, said Burgoyne. You mark my words, the curtain is about to rise for the drama.
Next morning, more news which disquieted both men still further came to the residency. A fakir of exceptional holiness had arrived in Bumali. The news made both sit up at once, for both knew these fakirs very well. Experts, every one of them, at rousing the passions of the mob.
I hear, said Burgoyne, that he has been sitting for 2 days without speaking a single word under the sacred peepal tree outside the city walls. What do you make of that?
Very clever, that silence. When he does speak, his message will be listened to.
Not a doubt of it, Burgoyne agreed. Let's go out and have a look at him.
They found the holy man seated under the great spreading tree which sheltered the shrine of Gaupati. At a respectful distance, a large crowd stood regarding him with awe-struck eyes, and Burgoyne heard that people were flocking in hourly from the outlying villages to see the holy man who had suddenly appeared. None knew whence or why. From the outskirts of the crowd, the two Englishmen for a while watched the man, who sat there cross-legged and motionless, like a tailor cut out of stone. Both wished for a closer sight of him, but the mob did not appear to be as willing as usual to make way for the sahibs, and Burgoyne, as resident, would not risk a possible insult at that moment. Purchase, however, as a stranger, had more freedom to display curiosity, and accordingly he passed through the throng till he reached the inner fringe of the crowd. Then, amazed by what he saw, he even advanced a few steps into the open space which the deference of the spectators kept between themselves and the fakir and his servant. Before him sat the holy man, as motionless as the image of the god above his head and as naked. But there wasn't an inch of him that wasn't bedaubed with paint. He was all a riot of color. His face was scarlet, and his eyes, with circles round them, looked like the centers of two targets. Hanging from his yellow neck by a blue ribbon was the representation of a quart pot, foaming. Startled beyond measure, Purchase cast a look at the servant who stood beside his master, and who was as freely bedecked with color, though without the other's fancy decorative designs. He was bandy-legged. Again Purchase's stare went back to the master, and as he looked him full in the face he distinctly saw the holy man's left eyelid droop at him for an instant. A murmur ran like a wave through the crowd when they saw how deeply the sahib was impressed. Impressed? It was a feeble word. John Purchase was being torn by conflicting emotions, both anger and laughter struggling in him for expression. Of course, he dared not give vent to either. And so, wheeling abruptly round, he pushed his way clear and rejoined his friend. Burgoyne had seen enough to be aware that something unusual had occurred, but he asked no questions till they were once more in his bungalow. Purchase had not mentioned his encounter with the two men at Karapur. Indeed, Alf and Fred had passed out of his mind. Burgoyne heard the tale with amazement.
"Do you think they are up to some game?" he asked.
"Just a lark," said Purchase, "a silly rotten lark."
"It will be a costly one for them. They are sure to be found out, and then—"
He made a gesture. "Oh, deuce take them. Can't we get them cleared out before then?"
"They'll not be allowed to go. Don't you see, whether detected or not, and the chances are that the Rajah's people already know they are frauds, they are being mighty useful. See how excited that crowd was. To a certainty, the holy man will be taken into the temple on the night of the Tamasha."
"On the night of the Tamasha," Purchase cried. "If only I knew what night that was." Burgoyne stared at him.
"You don't mean to say—" he began.
"I mean to be there," the other said with finality. "Do help me if you can." And when the appeal met with no response, he continued. "See here, Burgoyne, so far I've failed in this job. Am I to go back and say so? I'd sooner be skinned alive." Eagerly watching his friend's face, he saw he had made his point.
"Well," said Burgoyne, "the risk is awful, but of course you are right to take it, and if I can read the symptoms, it will be soon over.
The fact is, I think the gathering is for tonight. You saw that people were flocking in. Well, they are not all drawn by the fakir, for they could not have heard of his presence here so quickly. In any event, the meeting will be summoned in the usual fashion by the beating of a drum. We have only to listen for that.
But the drum was not heard that night, and Purchas, a prey to uncertainty, and chafing at the inaction forced upon him, passed a feverish, sleepless night. The next evening, however, he had scarcely changed into old Abdullah's toggery to be ready for a possible summons from Burgoyne, who was out on the veranda listening, when he himself heard the faint, far-away throbbing of a drum. In a few minutes he had done up his face to his friend's satisfaction, and very soon he was slipping along noiselessly in the direction of the temple. The old building stood well beyond the walls, a lonely place, encircled by peoples and deodars. When he was close enough to discern in the darkness the glimmer of the white walls, he diverged from the direct path and hung about watching many figures go stealing past him, like white moths among the dark tree trunks. When the flow of men had ceased, he ran forward and, passing under the side arches of the portico, slipped into a place just inside the doorway of the great inner shrine. He found the building to be full of squatting figures dimly lit by a few lanterns. And at the far end, high up the wall, he could just discern the niches occupied by the stone images of Gaupati, Lashni, and Nag. But in the center of the floor, instead of the pindi of Orthodox Hinduism, there was that which showed John Purchas that something unusual was indeed afoot. Seeing the tall column with the square top which stood there, he wondered if he were about to witness an act of that serpent worship which was said to be the oldest worship in the world. For a long time nothing happened. An old fat pujari standing under the column went on mumbling some sort of long ritual in a tongue not Punjabi. While this interminable and monotonous chant proceeded, Purchas cautiously surveyed the audience for any trace of the two masqueraders, thinking that if present they must now be in a fine state of funk. He found it eerie enough himself. But the low rumble of the old priest's voice ended at last, and a faint, thin, refined sound, as from some stringed instrument at a vast distance, became audible. All those squatting figures at once bowed forward thrice with machine-like precision, and Purchas, on the alert to copy the actions of those around him, was in time to do the trick twice, catching sight, as he did so, of two figures away on the left, and close to the column, who remained without motion. Even in the obscurity he knew who they were. Then the lanterns were extinguished suddenly and the darkness was complete. Prepared as Purchas was for any queer barbaric practice to follow, what actually did took him by surprise. Through the open doorway behind him, from the direction of the kneeling sacred bull of Shiva on the portico, there came a long spear of brilliant light, for all the world so like the shaft of light that goes over the spectators' heads from an old-type cinema lantern, that Purchas smiled at the incongruity. Smiled, that is, till he saw what it illuminated. That narrow spear of light caught the top of the column only, and on the flat top of the column he saw the gleaming coils of a huge sleeping snake, green and yellow and black. The music grew louder. A drum began, gently beaten, a queer sobbing note. And, roused either by the light or the music, the reptile slowly lifted its head and looked down, swaying from side to side. The beady eyes caught and reflected the light. Purchas saw them glittering, like little green jewels. Every soul in the building was prostrate on the floor, their heads reverently covered with some portion of their garments. Lying prone like the others around him, Purchas yet watched from beneath the fold of Abdullah's robe, which he had drawn over his head. Then, above the viper's head, he saw such a dazzling point of light as a poet might have imagined for the Star of Bethlehem. In a moment, he saw what it was. Around the serpent's neck was a ring of yellow metal from which, at the back, rose a slender rod some 5 inches long, and from this, by a thin wire or a hair, something at least invisible, the flashing jewel was suspended. John Purchas thrilled as he looked,
for he knew he was gazing at the lost Bumali diamond, the stone with the fabled origin, the gift of Nag, which had been the secret of the Sundra's power over northern India, and which had earned for that dynasty the title of Sons of the Serpent, a title which, even in their decline after its loss, the Sundra still lived up to. As Purchas lay watching while the little point of light twisted and turned at the end of the suspending hair, he wondered what all this portended. Was it a trick? Was this the real jewel or one substituted for a purpose? If so, what? Was he about to witness some hocus-pocus? Perhaps some pretended return of the gift to the present Foxy Raja from Nag to empower him, like his far-off ancestor, to drive out the Sahibs from Nag's domains? But suddenly his speculations were scattered by a sharp, angry hiss from the viper on the pillar. In the death-like silence it sounded so horribly full of all malice and evil that the watcher's nerves jumped to the sound. His blood chilled and contracted, as if from a sudden injection of icy water. He saw that others beside himself must have been taking a fearful peep at the ancient serpent and the sacred stone, for heads suddenly went down here and there around him. But Purchas did not suppose that venomous hiss to be a reproof of impiety, and so he continued watching, to see what had aroused the brute's anger. He was almost sorry he did, for what followed startled him horribly. Above the heads of the prostrate natives, as high as the tall pillar itself, he saw a hand. It came out of the darkness slowly and passed into the spear of light. It was impossible to tell what the hand was like or to whom it belonged, whether to native or to European, whether to the dead or to the living, for a very simple reason. It was covered with a white cotton glove. Indeed, all that Purchas actually saw of the hand was but the thumb and forefinger, yet these were so large and misshapen that they must have belonged to a giant or a beast. But no beast or giant was visible behind them. The finger and thumb, though attached to a hand and arm, were certainly detached from any body. They crept slowly nearer and nearer to the viper, keeping just above its swaying head. Then Purchas saw them close on the jewel, saw them give a swift tug and jerk, and the next instant both jewel and hand had vanished. But even before the diamond disappeared, John Purchas thought he understood the kind of game he was witnessing. Though he couldn't imagine how the trick with the hand had been done, he knew well enough the astonishing feats a Hindu juggler could do, and he was quite sure it was a trick. Presently, he thought, that hand will approach the Raja and bestow the diamond on him as a gift from Nag, and as a symbol of a new divine authority committed to the Sundra. But Purchas was very quickly undeceived. There must have been some other impious person present, a priest, perhaps, or Duleep Sundra himself. Anyhow, someone saw the diamond go, for a sudden cry of horror rang through the building. Heads must have been lifted. Like an echo, the cry was taken up by numberless voices, and dark forms leaped to their feet. In a moment, all was confusion, shouting and jostling. Purchas ran out by the door behind him, across the portico, leaped down the steps, and shot straight into the forest. Yet, quick as he had been, he was not quite the first, for he saw at least two leaping figures in front. He heard many following, for the wrath of the Sundra was apt to be wholesale and undiscerning. An hour later, when he was again in Burgoyne's study and had told his story, a little reflection threw some light on the mystery.
"The two masqueraders did it," said Burgoyne at length.
"It is incredible," Purchas affirmed. "Two private soldiers."
"A draper and a furniture remover. Furniture remover is good, eh? Smash and grab raider, I'd guess."
There was a lot of talk about this diamond among them at Lahore, of course.
"Oh, it was an admirably planned coup," said Burgoyne.
"Still, it is incredible that those two planned it. Think of the preparations, the intimate knowledge of native life needed."
"Ah, my boy, your new criminal is very different, I'm told."
"I see what you mean. Even so, how was it done?" Purchas asked.
"Ah, that I can't tell you. Wish I knew. Anyhow, the Duleep Sundra plot is at an end. You can bank on that. The Raja won't have an ounce of credit in India once the story spreads. It will be said that Nag took back his gift."
On the following day, Purchase returned to Lahore. Burgoyne, in seeing him off, begged that if ever he ran across his two friends in that city, he should find out how the trick with the gloved hand was done and let him know. Purchase promised, though with little hope that he would ever be able to keep that promise. On arrival, he hurried out to headquarters, knowing how much his news would serve to dispel his chief's anxiety. Rather to his surprise, when he was ushered in, he found the old man in very cheerful spirits. He listened happily to Purchase's tale until the splendor of the diamond was mentioned.
"Poof," said the chief, "there are many better stones in the windows of Bond Street."
"I assure you," Purchase protested.
"A very ordinary stone," the old man interrupted. "Look at it for yourself."
He put his hand into his pocket and clapped the diamond down on the desk. There was a long silence, during which a great respect for his chief was born in John Purchase's mind. He remembered his first impression on setting out of being himself but a pawn in the game, and now he wondered who were the big pieces this consummately skillful player had maneuvered. Alf and Fred? But who, then, were Alf and Fred? He put the question. The chief smiled and shrugged his shoulders.
"Didn't they tell you? They might be men from your friend Blaine's regiment," he said. "They are a very mixed lot, didn't you say?"
Purchase saw he had been indiscreet. Still, one other question he risked. He would risk it, though he now knew he had been sent to Bumale to draw suspicion on himself while the real experts did the job.
"I should like it, sir," he said humbly, "if you could suggest how the trick was actually done."
The chief's eyes twinkled with approbation.
"Mr. Purchase," he said, "I'll tell you all about it. I was once waiting for my wife. We were newly married then, outside a draper's shop in Oxford Street. The window was full of trumpery knick-knacks, and some were hanging against the glass. While I stood there, a lady and a little girl came up, and the little girl straightway fell in love with a string of coral beads which hung on a line in the very front of the window. They went inside, and I waited, curious to see how on earth the coral beads could be reached, wondering how much stuff would have to be taken out to get even near those beads. Well, it was very simple. The shopman had a pair of pincers at the end of two long, thin bamboo poles. Had that instrument been enclosed in a long sleeve, and if only the pincers had had a glove, say a soldier's white cotton glove on them, you might have thought it was two deft fingers at the end of a very long arm, so neatly were those coral beads removed. A very trivial thing to remember so long, you say to yourself, perhaps. Ah, well, you never know. You never know.